Hello, I'm Jacob Barnett. I'm a senior PhD student here, and this is basically a practice run for my thesis defense. So, if at all possible, please provide questions or criticisms, yelling encouraged. Okay, so I'm going to talk to you a bit about the research I've done over the last couple of years. I've been studying a non-Hermitian variant of quantum theory. So, firstly, I'm going to explain what Hermitian quantum theory is, then I'm going to explain what non-Hermitian quantum theory is. Once I've done that, I plan on telling you the unique things that I've learned about this theory. So these are summarized in two papers. This one's been submitted and this one's been published. And then afterwards, I'll summarize this and discuss some possibilities for future projects. Okay, so how hermeticity works in normal quantum theory, the kinematical structure is that of a Hilbert space. A Hilbert space is this nice complex vector space that has a notion of geometry and limits. Geometry is derived through the inner product, which is this function of two vectors. And so the first thing is I'm going to liberally assume that the Hilbert spaces are finite dimensional because that's going to simplify basically everything I'm going to say. So already you'll notice up here that I didn't specify that these are elements of a dense subset of the Hilbert space. I can just define this inner product for any pair of vectors. Yeah, so anyway, so this is the adjoint of an operator. It says that I can switch from moving it from this first input of an inner product to the second one, and a Hermitian observable is one which is self-adjoint. And you compute the averages of observables using this particular quadratic form. The reason why you assume that Hermitian observables are Hermitian is because, firstly, that expectation value is a real number for Hermitian observables. And secondly, Hermitian observables have a spectral decomposition, which means that the states generate probability measures, and you can talk about the probability of measuring a certain subset of the spectrum. Secondly, Hermitian Hamiltonians generate unitary time evolution. So a mathematician would think of a unitary as an isometry on a Hilbert space, but a physicist would think of it as this sort of constraint that says the total sum of probability in your system is 100%, and that's a constant in time. Okay, so hermeticity implies these two things. It's a sufficient but not necessary condition. The sufficient and necessary condition, again in finite dimensions, is this thing called quasi-hermeticity. An operator is quasi-Hermitian if and only if instead it satisfies this relaxed constraint for some positive definite metric operator. If I choose this to be the identity, I get back to normal hermeticity. So this is maybe a first reason for why you might be interested in non-Hermitian operators. So I plan on going through five of these. So right now, I guess we're talking about fundamental quantum theory.
So quasi-Hermitian has baked into it. It should be called something like eta quasi-Hermitian.
Yes, so the mathematicians, they'll call these things eta self-adjoint. Yeah.
So it does depend on eta, it doesn't drop out.
Sorry?
It does depend on eta, it doesn't drop out.
Yes. Yeah, you get a different kinematical structure for each eta. And there's a non-trivial question of if I give you a particular operator, what are the etas associated to it? So usually, if you want to fix one unique eta, you'll consider an irreducible set of operators, and somehow that uniquely defines an eta. Is that good? Okay. But then you can say, Jake, well, you didn't actually do anything, because all you did was you changed the inner product. But if I call this the physical inner product, that's a Hilbert space, isn't it? Again, in finite dimensions, yes, not in infinite dimensions. But the thing is, through this operator, eta, you can get new notions of locality and time than you would by blindly constructing inner products in this way. So, for example, in the tensor product model of locality, you have this thing factorizing as a tensor product, but this operator, eta, can have entanglement in it. So this generates new inner products that you wouldn't consider otherwise. So in summary, these things are equivalent, but if we talk about quantum theory with a notion of locality, quasi-Hermitian theory generally generalizes Hermitian theory. Okay, second reason, you might be interested in the quantum gravity problem, and there's some rhymes between what we talked about earlier. There's these new notions of locality and time, and these are some works that sort of elaborate on this. There's some ideas that in curved space-time, if you do certain approximations, you can end up with a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian, a time-dependent inner product. And furthermore, here's some non-commutative geometry, which generates non-Hermitian observables. So then you say, okay, well, I don't care about fundamental physics, right? I want to just use Hermitian quantum theory to derive the results of experiments. I say, fine, but yeah, so this is an idealization of quantum theory. Now, the most important part of this idealization is that we've chosen a very handsome observer. Okay. Anyway, so usually you're not interested in your entire system, you're interested in just a subsystem. As an example, in thermal physics, you're interested in just the macroscopic observables. You don't want to describe the entire microstate of the system. Another example, in open quantum theory, you have an environment and an actual small number of qubits that you care about. And so we only care about the observables in the subsystem. Now, if you have stuff moving from the subsystem into the system, you don't need unitarity. Why would probability sum to 100% if stuff is leaving your subsystem? Okay. So this is where you can get another notion of non-hermeticity. For example, the Lindblad-Master equation. If you're sufficiently edgy, you'll realize that it's just a non-Hermitian Schrodinger equation. Similarly, there's other renormalization techniques that will give you non-Hermitian operators. And so then you could ask, okay, well, what kind of non-Hermitian operators do we actually care about? Are we just going to study a general one? And sure, yeah, you could do that if you wanted to. But I care about some specific ones that are physically motivated. So one thing that we care about, we had this example of thermodynamics, and you might want your partition function to be a real number. That's a reasonable thing. Another thing that you might want is time reversal symmetry. Okay. And so Wigner taught us that time reversal symmetry is represented by an antilinear symmetry of the Hamiltonian. Not a linear one, an antilinear one. And so here I have this nice sort of description of operator classes. So we have Hermitian things down here. We saw these are a special case of the quasi-Hermitian. Turns out everything that's quasi-Hermitian, again in finite dimensions, has some antilinear symmetry. You don't necessarily know what it is in advance, but it exists. Something that's kind of nice about antilinear symmetries as opposed to linear symmetries is that you can have spontaneous symmetry breaking of an antilinear operator even in zero dimensions, just for a qubit, and with zero temperature. And physically, the spontaneous symmetry breaking of an antilinear operator will tell you whether your spectrum is real or not. So it turns out that every operator, finite dimensions, with a real spectrum is unbroken antilinear symmetric, where what that means is there's no spontaneous symmetry breaking. The eigenstates are also an eigenstate of this antilinear operator. Okay. Fourth reason. You say, okay, well, I'm still not satisfied with that. I really just want to study Hermitian operators. I say, fine, but it may be that by generalizing your Hermitian operators to non-Hermitian ones, you can actually learn about the original Hermitian ones. Okay, so as an example, this is a linear Hamiltonian in one parameter. Many of our favorite Hamiltonians look like this. If you analytically continue this to a complex parameter, you get a non-Hermitian Hamiltonian. And for example, the spectrum of this will usually look like some Riemann surface, which will have different Riemann sheets. And you'll see branch cuts in the Riemann sheets. And the location of those branch cuts will tell you whether your perturbative series for your Hermitian model converges or not. Okay. Lastly, you say, I don't care about quantum mechanics. I say, fine. But you still might want to study a non-Hermitian operator, even if you don't care about quantum mechanics. Because the Schrodinger equation is a mathematical equation, and one of the things that's beautiful about mathematics is that equations will describe things in many different contexts. So yes, we're used to describing the evolution of wave packets with Schrodinger's equations, but it shows up in other contexts too. For example, in optics, this is a real experiment they did. So here, this is a laser. It provides optical pumping into a very thin waveguide, which is collected through here. The waveguide has a complex refractive index. And as a consequence of the complex refractive index, if you go to Maxwell's equations, you linearize it, use the so-called paraxial approximation, you get a non-Hermitian Schrodinger equation describing this. So here's a paper which summarized the experiment, published in Nature, over 2,000 citations. And this guy took the picture. Some of you may know about this web comic from PhD Comics. So in 2015, he thought that non-Hermitian physics was one of the top 10 discoveries. Now you'll notice that all of these names are puns. So he didn't call it parity time symmetry, he called it party time, and these things are kind of dancing around. So in electrical circuits, you'll run into a non-Hermitian operator. So this is a circuit, which is just a linear circuit. All the components are linear elements. Here we have an operational amplifier. Here we have a resistor. So this resistor acts as a source of loss. Operational amplifier acts as a source of gain. You look at the Kirchhoff equations, non-Hermitian matrix. Here's some driven pendula. These are driven by electromagnetic motors and is set up in a way such that these are balanced, and this is described by a PT symmetric Hamiltonian. Okay, and here's a reference. So hopefully I've maybe convinced you of a couple of reasons why you might care. Now let's look at some of the mathematical properties of these non-Hermitian models. Okay, so this is a qubit, about as simple as it gets, and we're going to start with something that just looks Hermitian. So if I take Z, which is this parameter, to be a real number, I get a Hermitian matrix. Spectrum, you can exactly calculate it, it's a quadratic equation. And the Riemann sheets look like this. So for real values of the parameter, due to hermeticity, you have real eigenvalues. But interestingly enough, on the imaginary axis between these two so-called exceptional points, you also have a real spectrum. And the reason for why goes back to this idea of antilinear symmetry, which is, so I could graphically represent that model. You have a source of probability and a sink of probability represented by I gamma minus I gamma. So I have this parity operator, which flips the system around, and time reversal, which changes a source to a sink. And this model has this PT symmetry. So therefore, you would expect that along this imaginary axis, you can still see a real spectrum. And similarly, you can consistently define quantum theory even with this non-Hermitian operator. Yep?
Good question. Why is that interpretable as a source and a sink? Is there an easy way to see that?
Yeah, so if you try to blindly write down like the evolution due to Schrodinger equation, you usually have something that looks like this. You have this exponentiated operator. And so if I just called this like I gamma, this looks like e to the t gamma. So it looks like you have some source of probability. Okay. But if the coupling strength between the source and the sink is strong enough, you can get this balanced loss and gain, and it cancels, and you still get like a conserved system. Okay. Now, furthermore, you'll notice that at the exceptional point, the eigenvectors coalesce at the exceptional point. So this matrix is non-diagonalizable there. This is a unique degeneracy that you won't see in a Hermitian system. Okay, so that explains the qubit example. I'm going to show you some new things, hopefully. Okay, so what's more complicated than 2, 3? So now what I've done is I've added an extra site between my two sites. And I have this detuning potential delta, which didn't matter before because it would just be a shift by identity, but now it does matter because I've added this extra site in the middle. And so now our Riemann sheets, instead of just having two sheets, we have three. And so because this is a function of two parameters, now I have coalescence along an entire curve. This is an algebraic curve. And furthermore, it has this extra singular structure. At this extra singular structure, you see all three of the eigenvectors coalesce instead of just two. So they call this a higher order exceptional point. And something that I specifically have shown is that this correspondence is generically true. So generically, at these cusp points of these algebraic curves, you have a higher order degeneracy. It's a straightforward argument from perturbation theory. The assumptions you have to make is that the characteristic polynomial for this thing has a linear expansion that makes sense. And so if that isn't the case, then this correspondence won't hold. So here's a further generalized version, right? So even more complicated than 3, now we have n. Ooh. And so these curves, this yellow curve is what we saw before. This thing sort of approaches the unit disk. How am I doing on time? When did I start?
You have another, say, 10 minutes.
I have another 10 minutes. Okay, cool. So because I have a little bit of extra time, I can maybe explain why this turns into a circle. So the first thing that I found was kind of funny was that these exceptional points sort of indicate a point where the standard perturbation theory breaks down because you have this square root structure instead of this linear structure. So then you can ask, okay, Jake, well, how do you analyze exceptional points? And you use perturbation theory. Yeah, so you can do a perturbative approximation to this curve and it ends up working out. Yeah, I just thought that was funny. So the reason why the threshold past delta equals 1 is vanishing as opposed to finite is because of the presence of edge states. Edge states, for those who are familiar with topological insulators, are what's responsible for allowing conductivity in the boundary of a topological insulator. Okay. Let's see. So here, you have these edge states, and as you turn on the non-hermeticity, these will spontaneously break, and you'll see them localize at edges of the chain. And so because of that, the spectrum corresponding to these edge states is complex. But in this phase, this topologically trivial phase, where you don't have edge states, you can have a finite threshold where the spectrum is still real.
Can you go back to the last slide for a second? What is the meaning of this graph? What are you plotting here? Delta, gamma, and the...
Right. So, yeah, so these are exceptional points. So you see up here, we have this coalescence of multiple Riemann sheets for these values of parameters. And all I did was I just took that curve and I generalized it to an n-site model. So this yellow curve is the black curve. Okay. And you can make this whole topological insulator argument a little more clear by studying a non-Hermitian perturbation of the Sue-Scheffer-Heeger chain. This chain was originally used to describe solitons in a hydrocarbon. And so you have these two hopping amplitudes, which are different. And so now I've got three parameters. Ooh, so I've got a 3D surface. And so this surface, you have these ridges of exceptional points, and they have more exceptional points. So these are fourth order, these cusp points. Okay, now I want to talk a little bit about locality. We're making our system a little more complicated. I've got my supersymmetric twin over here who can only do measurements in this subsystem. So I can do measurements in this subsystem. And ideally, I should be able to perform my measurements simultaneously with Jacobina. Okay, so mathematically, the way we do this is by assuming that the sets of observables in two distinct regions commute. And mathematically, I'm going to assume that these things look like C-star algebras. If you want, you can make them von Neumann factors too. Okay, so for quasi-Hermitian theory, what'll happen is your inner product structure can take your local operator algebra and map it into something which is not itself, because this eta thing is a non-local operator. So as a consequence, when I want to talk about local observables, I want to talk about things that are both local and quasi-Hermitian. I want to talk about the algebra that's generated by that, and you can show that this is just living in the intersection of these two sets. So I take my local operator algebra, I conjugate it under this metric operator, I look at the intersection, these are where my observables live. And the important thing to note is that this is smaller than this in general. Okay. For example, one set of commuting operators you can generate is the so-called tensor product model. This is what generically corresponds to type 1 von Neumann factors. There's this nice paper by Roos from 1970 which demonstrates that. The important thing to note here is that the local algebras will generate the entire algebra. And so what that means is that an arbitrary operator can be written as sums of products of local operators. So for example, the metric, you could write it as a sum of products of local operators. But again, because there's a sum of these, as opposed to just a single term, this cannot be expressed as a tensor product of two inner products. So furthermore, the local operator algebras, since they're smaller, do not generate the entire algebra. So in summary, quasi-hermeticity allows you to generalize the notion of locality you get from a tensor product. However, you could say, oh, well, if you have this more general notion of locality, why haven't I seen it in an experiment? Because it's impossible. So I have this impossibility proof that says that local measurements, despite the fact these two models are different, cannot distinguish between these two theories. A corollary of that is that the bounds you can put on Bell inequality violations in non-Hermitian quantum theory is exactly the same as in normal quantum theory. So here I just have a little sketch of the proof. So basically what I do is I first look for a positive definite operator, which is sort of local to one of your subsystems, which is generated by this. You can prove that exists. Okay, then once you have that, you do some mumbo jumbo. So we're going to start with our algebra of physical observables, K, Contained in that is an algebra of local observables, which we can show is also in this algebra that I got from this operator xi, which is this local thing. And then from here, because xi is local, I can do a local similarity transform back to my Hermitian model. So one thing that's maybe a little unsatisfactory about this proof is that I use the Hahn-Banach extension theorem. And as a consequence, in infinite dimensions, this proof is not constructive. Secondarily, the time evolution of this state is not given by a Hamiltonian in general. It's given by a CPTP map. So if you actually stayed in the original non-Hermitian framework, the description of your system may be simpler. So here's a summary of the things that I've learned. Is that we generalize the notion of locality, but we do so in a tame way, that we don't generate new Bell inequality violations. And that there's some interesting connections between perturbations of non-Hermitian operators and algebraic geometry. In particular, higher order exceptional points occur at cusp singularities of algebraic curves. Here's just a small list of things that I'm interested in working on in the future. If you want to talk about this at any point, I'd be more than happy to. So for example, one thing that I might want to know is all the models that I studied earlier were like non-interacting models. There's just a fixed number of particles. And so there's a question of, because the kind of entanglement that you can have in a non-Hermitian theory is different, because your inner product can be entangled, do you have to somehow change the architecture for your traditional ansatz for non-Hermitian many-body systems? Similarly, I'm interested in other notions of second quantization, such as if you have like a topological superconductor that you put a non-Hermitian perturbation to, say Kataev's quantum wire, how would that work? What does the inner product look like? I talked about local expectation values. That's just a spatial thing. I'm also interested in a temporal thing. And so there's a nice notion of local time evolution, which comes straight from the observable algebras, which is given by the so-called Tomita Takasaki construction. And I'm interested to see what that looks like. Furthermore, from Tomita Takasaki, you can talk about entanglement. You have this so-called relative modular operator, which is in some sense equivalent to a von Neumann definition for entanglement entropy. And so I'd be interested in studying entanglement entropy. I'm interested in understanding what the physical meaning of this entangled inner product is. So I believe I'm probably about out of time now. So if you have any questions, please let me know. Yeah?
You said that there's no local experiment that can distinguish between having the positive non.
Yes.
Yeah. Is there any notion of like a global experiment that would, in any kind of way?
That's an interesting question that I don't know the answer to. So yeah, this impossibility proof is only for local measurements. If you had some sort of global measurement or some way of like detecting entanglement, maybe you could tell a difference between the two theories.
Yeah, we're going to have that. And I have another question. I don't know if someone else wants to ask something else. But it's have you looked at the algebraic formulation for quantum field theory at all? And try to think about how these ideas would fit into that. Because we're going to say that once you formulated things with the whole local algebras of observables, sure, you had type 1 algebras in mind, in that case it's type 3, but I think that like looking like having this kind of like mindset and looking at what people have in quantum field theory, like from the algebraic perspective, might really fit into this. It's also related to me, like a second theory and things like this. You might be interested in that.
Yeah, so non-Hermitian quantum field theories turn out to be quite interesting as well. So the space of quantum field theories is very heavily constrained by constraints such as renormalizability, or Lorentz invariance, or gauge invariance. So having any sort of generalization is quite good. One quantum field theory that we have, for example, looks like this. So I could have like a, let's see. I have like a Hamiltonian that looks like I have my momentum operator. So this is one thing that's been studied. This sort of emerges in different notions of renormalization. And so definitely one thing that would be interesting is, for example, for this quantum field theory, so can one come up with a non-perturbative understanding of what the inner product associated to that is? And then once you have that, can you talk about local observable algebras, right? So that's an interesting question. I particularly haven't really done too many of the calculations in the field theory setting. So, I mean, I have some understanding of the non-interacting case for spinless particles, but that's about as far as my knowledge goes.
Is that just the Li-Yang model that Hamiltonian?
I don't know what the Li-Yang model is. So. Maybe.
I think so.
Okay.
That Hamiltonian is in four dimensions?
I mean, we could put a coupling constant in here too, but I think you could define this in any number of dimensions.
That's what your criteria are.
Yeah. Yep.
So you mentioned that there is singular points where the spectrum kind of merge. That seems to contradict this one result. I forgot the names, like Wigner von Neumann.
Sorry?
Wigner von Neumann.
Stone von Neumann?
Yeah, which says that, like, let's say you have a Hamiltonian and then you have, like, n parameters. Then the spectrum cannot meet in any dimension which is more than n minus 2.
You have to assume hermeticity for. Yeah, that's the Wigner von Neumann. You have to assume hermeticity for that argument to be true. So
okay,
one
so
thing that
the generalization methods.
I don't know if there is a generalization of Wigner and von Neumann's result to non-Hermitian operators. So actually, this sort of feature, you see level attraction here as opposed to level repulsion. Mm-hmm. Level attraction is generic. So for example, one result from Motzkin and Toski is that if I give you let's say I give you two operators, and I construct a linear combination of them, and these things don't commute. This will necessarily have an exceptional point. There will be a point where these levels coalesce. And you don't even have to do anything fancy to like fix the number of parameters. There's just one parameter here, and you already get it. So, I mean, if you want, you could say this is like a smooth complex manifold. Is that what you're looking for?
Yeah, like a square job, so you have a regular rock which allows you to count these things, right?
What, like some intersection cohomology sort of thing? Yeah, so.
You know, having this eta thing, this stuff would be pretty well controlled, right? Like I would be able to.
So the thing with the eta is there's a very important constraint, which is that my eta needs to be positive definite in order to define closed quantum theory. And so let's say for this model, I could try to define an eta on the imaginary axis. So that eta would also be a function of the parameter, just like the Hamiltonian. And that eta is no longer positive definite as you pass the exceptional points. So it's positive definite on the inside, and then it's just Hermitian and invertible on the outside.
So for this model, the eta depends on z. Is that your claim?
Yes. Well, at least the positive definite one. So for example, one eta, which is maybe z independent, would be probably something like sigma x, I think, would work. Yeah. So if you want, you could say the eta is dynamically determined. If you fix a Hamiltonian, there's a problem of determining what etas are associated to it. So if this is dependent on the parameter, so will this.
All right.
Sorry, but I have to go put on my TA hat.
Okay. You need this?
No, I don't.
Oh.
You should continue the discussion over snacks and on the history.
Big brain.
Okay. Okay, I'll just help you. That's really nice.